Senator.
The Commonwealth has filed a Naples the Third Appellant Counsel, Virginia B. Tyson, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My name is Pat Naples, and I represent the appellate in this case, Mr. Gregory Perry. At this time, I intend to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Virginia's Speedy Trial Act is designed to protect criminal defendants. And in this case, the Commonwealth agrees that Mr. Perry was not brought to trial within the five-month period mandated by the Act. The question before this Court is whether the Commonwealth can meet its burden to charge sufficient time to Mr. Perry to bring the prosecution back within the bounds of the Act. Primarily, the Commonwealth cannot do so in this case because the second delay before trial occurred from December 4th, 2014 until February 9th, 2015 cannot be equitably charged to Mr. Perry when all he did was assert his fundamental right to a jury trial. This Court has long held that the burden is on the Commonwealth to prove that time should be charged to the defendant in a criminal case. And yet, in this case, the Commonwealth did not sufficiently establish a record at the pretrial proceedings to charge the second delay in this case to Mr. Perry. The transcript of the December 4th, 2014 hearing reveals this very point. In the discussion of the delay of Mr. Perry's jury trial from that December 4th date until February 9th, the first question that was asked Mr. Perry was whether he wanted a jury trial. Mr. Perry replied that he did, and the circuit court stated that obviously that necessitates a continuance.
Was the prior order continuing the date to December 4 for a bench trial?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Was there any objection to it being set for a bench trial?
There was not, Your Honor. But the initial order that made this a bench trial that was entered on September 15 was done by Mr. Perry's counsel without his knowledge and without his consent. And on October 29th, Mr. Perry wrote the court and informed them that he was not present at that September 15th
hearing. But the judge is assuming that counsel representing the defendant has apparent authority to make such representations and apparent authority not to object when certain things are done inconsistent with the client's wishes.
There's no doubt that that's what happened, Your Honor. However, in this particular instance, Mr. Perry had already wrote to both the Circuit Court and the Commonwealth on August 28th and put both on notice that he desired a jury trial. And then on October 29th,
he was represented by counsel at that point, is that right?
No, Your Honor.
No?
No. That was days before his counsel had been appointed that
okay.
He sent that letter.
So his counsel, after those letters came in, didn't object and agreed to the bench trial continuance order to December 4.
Correct, Your Honor. The issue here, however, is whether on December 4th, at the time that Mr. Perry requested a jury trial, has the Commonwealth put sufficient evidence before this court to then charge Mr. Perry with the two-month-plus delay that then accrued in the case after that time? And our position is that they have not put forth that evidence. There is no question that in this case that the court didn't entertain whether a different prosecutor could have been used to speed up proceedings. The court didn't entertain whether a different judge could have presided over the case. And the court didn't entertain whether another case that wouldn't have had speedy trial implications involved in this case could have been substituted for Mr. Perry's case. Any evidence regarding why an over two-month delay was necessary was not put forth by the Commonwealth in this case. And then, when a date of January 8th was proposed to the Commonwealth's attorney rejected it as insufficient to obtain service of process on witnesses.
Would the time from January 8th to February 9th brought your client within the five-month period? Had that not been charged, and you're saying it was continued from the 8th because the prosecutor couldn't get service of process out?
If the time from January 8th to February 9th is the loan period excluded, then that is not sufficient in order to grant Mr. Perry relief in this case. But what does happen in this case is it demonstrates the fact that the Commonwealth did not accept that February that January 8th to February 9th period of exclusion demonstrates that the Commonwealth simply was not concerned with Mr. Perry's right to a speedy trial. Because even if the Commonwealth believed that November 5th until December 4th, the first delay in this period, in this trial, could have been charged to Mr. Perry, that February 9th date was still outside of the bounds of the Speedy Trial Act. And so to return to your question, Your Honor, about the delay from January 8th until February 9th, if that period is excluded, plus if that period is included, plus the period from November 5th to December 4th, then that would grant Mr. Perry relief.
Well, November 5th to December 4th, the defendant consented to the continuance, am I right?
He did not object to the continuance, Your Honor, and his counsel on September 15th did not acquiesce to the Commonwealth's request for continuance.
That's did you say acquiesced?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so therefore it's not chargeable against the Commonwealth.
Your Honor, the statute speaks of a situation, speaks of a general situation which the failure to object does not, is not a basis for charging time to the Commonwealth. However, this presents a different situation where Mr. Perry put the court on notice of the fact that this was entered without his knowledge or without his consent. But the fact remains that even if that time period, that first delay, from November 5th until December 4th is charged to Mr. Perry, the period from December 5th, the second delay in this period, should still be charged to the Commonwealth. And the reason for that is the absence of any record that they've put forth to demonstrate why an over 60-day delay was necessary to bring forth a jury.
So can I clarify your point there? Are you saying that the earlier bench trial order, which defense counsel did not object to, and you show up on the bench trial, and on the morning of the bench trial, he asked for a jury, are you saying that any delay, any continuance of any nature for one day to get a jury would be chargeable to the Commonwealth? Or are you saying, well, some delay, but not as long as this?
Your Honor, I don't, I think that the position, the in this case, there was certainly no reason for any delay whatsoever because of the fact.
From what point in time, counsel? I'm sorry.
From
December 4th when he asked for a jury?
Yes, because the Commonwealth and the Circuit Court should have recognized prior to that December 4th date Mr. Perry's request for a jury trial based on the fact that he filed a motion in August of 2014 and then put the court on notice that when a bench trial was agreed to on September 15th, it was done without his knowledge, without his consent, and then he discharged his counsel. But instead of taking any further action, the Commonwealth and the Circuit Court decided to wait until the day of December 4th to even entertain his request for a jury trial.
But your point about the pro se asking for a jury and allegedly defense counsel waiving it on his behalf is a great point on the question of effective waiver of a jury trial. So if the trial judge had forced him into a bench trial, then you would probably have a Sixth Amendment argument. But we're not dealing with the Sixth Amendment here. Well, we're not dealing with the jury trial right here. We're dealing only with the statutory scheme for attributing delay. So why is it unfair under this statutory scheme for the trial judge who had been advised by defense counsel, I'm setting this down for a bench trial, to set it down for a bench trial?
The question, Your Honor, is not, I think, whether it's fair to Mr. Perry or fair for the court to take the action that it took. The question is whether the Commonwealth put forth sufficient evidence to then charge the delay that accrued to Mr. Perry. That's the question is whether the Commonwealth has met its burden.
Okay, the response they give is we did. We showed that the bench trial was set up by order and stipulated in order entered by the court. There was no objection. It was acquiescence by the defense counsel. And everyone, including the judge, was surprised on the morning of a bench trial that they didn't have a jury ready when a jury was asked for. Why isn't that okay? There's your evidence of why you needed to do what you did.
Even if there may be a justification for some delay, Your Honor, based on that point, The fact of the matter is that the Commonwealth didn't put forth any evidence on December 4th as to why a delay beyond the deadline of the Speedy Trial Act was necessary at that point in time. Even if it's accepted that the first delay was chargeable to Mr. Perry, then the Commonwealth and the Circuit Court still had almost 2 months in which to bring Mr. Perry before the court, before a jury trial. They didn't do so, and they put forth no sufficient evidence to suggest any alternative dates within that period or why any of those alternative dates were insufficient. Now,
but the reason it had to be continued was because on December 2nd, 2 days before the bench trial was scheduled, your client wanted a jury trial. And with regard to the letter that you sent on October 29th, your client sent on October 29th, I don't see anything about his objection to it being a bench trial. So by that point, he knew a bench trial was scheduled for December 4th, right?
That's unclear from the record as to whether he was aware, because he wasn't there on September 15th. And so it's not, while he is stating that he was aware that a continuance had been granted in that October 29th letter, it's not clear that he was aware until later than that that the trial had been changed from a bench trial to a jury trial. What Mr. Perry asserts is, I made a jury trial motion on August 28th, and I sent that to the court, and I sent that to the Commonwealth. And now,
on October 29th, when he objects, he doesn't say anything about bench trial versus jury trial.
That's true, Your Honor.
And the Court of Appeals opinion says, with regard to whether Perry was there or not, it actually says Perry was there. The order just says by counsel.
Correct, Your Honor. But the Court of Appeals erred in that point, because if you look at other orders that exist in the joint appendix, those orders at which we know Mr. Perry was present at the proceedings based on the transcripts specifically say that the defendant appeared in person, whereas the order from September 15th does not contain that in-person language that exists in the other orders. The fact remains that while Mr. Perry continuously asserted his right to be tried speedily, dating back to June 2014, when he moved to waive his preliminary hearing in the interest of expediting the litigation, all the way until February, when his trial was taking place, and even though his counsel had withdrawn a week before trial, he never requested a continuance. To contrast Mr. Perry's behavior with the Commonwealth's behavior, where they simply agreed to any and all delays that took place in this case, does not bring Mr. Perry's prosecution within the bounds of the Act. And for that reason, his conviction should be vacated.
Can I ask you one question about something different, counsel? In his pro se petition, the petitioner asked for two other assignments of error, which were granted by the panel, and one abandoned. Have they been abandoned because he is soon to be released and he doesn't want a retrial? Is that the reason why he's abandoned these assignments of error?
Right to counsel issue, that is his basis for abandoning the claim. The other issue involving the volume levels in the trial room was just based on discussions with counsel and his appraisal of the issue that was before.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Virginia Tyson for the Commonwealth. Virginia's appellate courts have long recognized that a delay in the commencement of a trial that is caused by the defendant is not chargeable to the Commonwealth for purposes of speedy trial. Since 1993, the legislature has recognized that concurrence by the accused or his counsel to a requested delay by the Commonwealth will not result in time being charged against the Commonwealth. And 192-243, as this court recently affirmed in Wallace, lists exceptions, but those exceptions are not an exhaustive list. And so it is our position that the time that was delayed in this case is chargeable to Mr. Perry. And I'm not absolutely certain if that first continuance has been conceded by the defense, and in case it has not, I want to say that based upon the statute and based upon the order from from September 17, 2014. That's a delay from November the 5th till December the 4th, chargeable to Mr. Perry, because at that time he was represented by counsel, counsel number one, Mr. Homiller. Mr. Homiller agreed to that continuance. The order indicates that it was continued for a bench trial. And so it was reasonable for the Commonwealth to not have a jury present on December 4th. Maybe one of the most important things that about the jury trial and the jury not being there on December 4th is that the prosecutor represented that he did not know until a couple of days before the December 4th hearing that there had been this earlier request. And whether the defendant said that he sent a certificate of service and sent it to the prosecutor on a couple of occasions, including at trial when the prosecutor was explaining to the trial judge that he did not know. This is 294 to 295 of the appendix and 349 and 350 of the appendix. So, and the trial judge on December 4th says, I believe this is at 196, that I didn't know you wanted a jury until I'm sitting here right now.
What, if any, impact is there that apparently such a request had been mailed to the clerk's office and somehow was misplaced?
Your Honor, it was. It was misplaced, and the I think we cited to the record at 174 on this. The court, when they found it in November, sent him a letter and said, we had misplaced this along with a discovery request and maybe another motion. We have now found it and we have processed it. I think that it is not of significance, however, given the facts of this case, in light of that order from September 17th, where the case was continued to December 4th for a trial without a jury. And then, as was noted earlier, even when the defendant pro se, while he's represented by counsel, writes a letter on October 29th to complain that he doesn't want his case continued, he doesn't say anything about his request for a jury. So all of those factors come
And do we know, I couldn't find it in the record, but do we know whether as of that date he was aware of the order that his counsel had?
Your Honor, I agree that that is not clear from the letter that he wrote. And he wrote a couple of additional ones shortly thereafter. It is not apparent from those as well. At that point, he's interested in discharging Mr. Homiller, his first counsel. So everyone arrives on December 4th, and there is no jury present, and the parties arrive. The defendant has indicated at a previous hearing that he is going to proceed pro se. And
can I interrupt you for a second? Hypothesize that the trial judge had been aware of the earlier pro se letter requesting a jury before he's represented by counsel. And I'm the trial judge, and I go, well, I just had a hearing, and counsel's been appointed, and counsel has acquiesced in setting this down for a bench trial. It wouldn't be likely that a typical trial judge would say, well, I'm not going to do that because I'm going to actually set up as a jury trial pursuant to a pro se letter entered prior to representation and prior to the more recent representation to the court that a bench trial was appropriate. So I'm not even sure that the presence or absence of the letter, if known, would affect the analysis.
I think that the order does, certainly is the most significant. I think in response to defense counsel's argument that the Commonwealth was somehow recalcitrant in not learning about this, the response that I wanted to make was there was a representation made by the prosecutor that he was not aware that the earlier request had even been made, and he made that that known even to the trial judge. And so the very first thing that the court asks of the defendant is whether he wants to have a jury trial, because that will determine what happens that day. The witnesses are present for a bench trial that day, but if it's going to be a jury trial, they can't do it. There's no jury there. If they can make it through the motions, they could have a bench trial. If they can make it through the motions in time, they cannot have a jury trial. And so because there is this request for a jury trial that is going to be honored by the court, the case must be set over. Now, counsel asked during his argument why wasn't it set during the time frame before December 29th, which is when the time would expire. The first date that was offered by the clerk is January 8th. And counsel said that January 8th is not enough time to get process on the witnesses. And whether that's a good answer or not, I think that it's not the best answer. It's not my best argument to say he needed that much time, particularly because he represented to the court in February that his witnesses were present. And I found this as I was preparing for this argument. At 2:15 and 2:16, he at least asked the court to recognize the witnesses back. And whether they're all there and whether they're all recognized is not clear from the record. But certainly, the better argument that I have is that in addition to the fact that this is set down for a jury, there is a request for counsel. And counsel, first standby counsel is requested for the trial, and then counsel, court-appointed counsel is requested. And a lawyer who was there in the courthouse agrees first to be standby counsel and then agrees to be court-appointed counsel, and he makes no objection to the February 9th date. And doing the math, even if this court were to find the time between January 8th and February 9th, which is 32 days, even if that were counted against the Commonwealth, that would not take us outside of the time limit. I don't think that this court has in the past, or any appellate court in the past, has in a situation like this looked to say, when everyone agrees when the case is going to be set, when counsel agrees, prosecution agrees, the case is going to be set, to say, I don't think you have a very good reason, Mr. Prosecutor, so we're going to only accept a little bit of the time that you want for your continuance. However, I would say that worst-case scenario for the Commonwealth in this case, and the January 8th to February 9th is excluded. That would be the only time that would be excluded, and that's not enough to go beyond the time period. The request that the defendant made at the December 4th hearing, first for the jury trial, after there was an order in place for a bench trial, and secondly, after having said that he would represent himself, asked for first standby counsel and then court-appointed counsel, it necessitated a continuance from that date. And it also, I think, is important, even beyond that counsel did not object, Mr. Brooks, who was counsel number two, did not object to the February 9th date, is that he was appointed right then and there for a jury trial on a violent felony. And certainly he is entitled to have time to prepare to represent the defendant at the hearing, at the trial, which is going to be a jury trial. And so that even is an additional reason why we look to why this doesn't take it outside of the time limit. The actions of the Commonwealth were reasonable given the information that the Commonwealth had as far as not having a jury present that day. The request for the continuance was necessary because of the actions of the defendant. And we cited on our brief the Heath case, which I think is somewhat analogous here in that situation there was a psychological evaluation that was needed by the defense, and the defense said, well, yes, I did ask for that, but the Commonwealth wanted a blood examination. And this court said, well, the trial could not happen until your psychological evaluation occurred. The trial could not happen here until a jury was available because the defendant wanted the jury trial. The trial could not happen here, at least as of December 4th, when there was a request for counsel. And of course, as the court knows, eventually he did represent himself at the jury trial when his second counsel was permitted to withdraw. But at the time that these decisions are being made, at the time that the case is being set, we have both the request for the jury and also the request for counsel. And the parties having arrived December 4th with this set of facts before them, the request is chargeable to the defendant in this case. This case was tried within the confines of the Speedy Trial statute. The court did not err in denying the motion to dismiss based on Speedy Trial. And we would urge this court to affirm the judgment below, finding there was no Speedy Trial violation. Unless there are other questions, we would ask the court to do that.
All right, rebuttal.
May it please the court. The Commonwealth has put forth a few justifications in its attempt to charge the time from December 4th until February 9th to Mr. Perry. They have said that they did not know about his request for a jury trial until December 4th, and that necessitated a continuance. But the record shows that Mr. Perry made his request as plainly as possible months earlier. And beyond that, they do not explain at all why an additional 2 months was necessary to impanel a jury. And with regard to the Heath case, it is clear in that instance that a motion to determine the capacity of the defendant necessitated the 30-day delay that was charged to the defendant in that case. What we're talking about here is a 60-plus day delay for a jury, which is quite different than a 30-day delay for a motion to determine the capacity of the defendant. And this is in accord with Stevens versus Commonwealth, which this court decided in 1983, in which the court held and emphasized the record that the Commonwealth had put forth in determining that there was oral argument on a motion to suppress, in determining that the court had entertained written briefs and written arguments. There is no such record in this case of any alternatives that have been evaluated, of any alternatives that were explored to bring Mr. Perry to trial within the bounds of the Act. And because the Commonwealth has not met that burden, which this court has established, Mr. Perry's conviction should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.